This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Joy, happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy, joy.
Eric Larson, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thanks a lot for having me on, Bill.
Eric Larson, L-A-U-R-S-E-N, is a independent journalist. His most recent major work is a book, The People's Pension, about Social Security and the continuing conservative attack on it. Eric Larson, tell us about today's crisis. Tell us about the crisis first and then how to solve it.
Sure. The first thing to understand is really Social Security is in a crisis. There is a real crisis, but it's not a fiscal crisis the way it's being presented all the time in the mainstream media. It's a political crisis. It's been going on for over 30 years now, really since the election of Ronald Reagan, and he began attacking the program, along with his budget director, David Stockman, who is still attacking it, by the way, in the media today. Since then, Social Security has been under almost continual assault from members of the political elite, not just conservative Republicans, but in a way, more critically, center-right Democrats, who really constitute these days the leadership of the Democratic Party, have been trying every which way to find some political formula that will allow them to cut Social Security, despite the fact that it is really the heart and soul of the New Deal Democratic Party, and without it, it's hard to understand why anybody would really think of the Democrats as having any kind of political personality at all. Fiscally, there is no crisis. Social Security is, according to the trustees of the program, it's well-funded until 2033, 2034. At that point, the trust fund runs out. Now, that's something, first of all, it's not a crisis in the sense that it doesn't mean that suddenly the country is going to go broke trying to fund Social Security. Social Security, by law, has to be funded from the payroll taxes that it brings in. It's a self-funded program. So Congress would have to either vote to raise the payroll tax or to bring in another source of revenue to prop it up as well. But there's no sense in which Social Security is driving the country into bankruptcy or any of the sort of nonsense that you hear from supposedly responsible people in Washington. There's also some fairly easy ways to correct the situation in advance. The most popular and plausible, actually, is to raise the cap, which means to raise the limit on income which is subject to payroll taxation, which is currently about $113,000 a year. One solution would be to raise that to $250,000. Bernie Sanders has proposed raising it on any amounts over $250,000. But either way, that would solve a big chunk of the problem right then and there. If the cap was completely eliminated and all income was taxed for payroll tax, then the crisis could, or supposed future crisis, would just about go away. There's other ways to handle it as well. It's actually possible to raise payroll taxes across the board just a little bit for employers and employees, and that would just about take care of the problem. That could be done gradually over 20 years such that it wouldn't cut into anybody's purchasing power. What you notice is that the ideas that do get a lot of traction in Washington are means testing the program, changing the CPI, consumer price index, that's used to calculate benefits, raising the retirement age, eliminating benefits for upper income people, all of which really translate into cuts in benefits. In other words, it's possible in Washington to talk politically about cutting benefits for people who need them or even people who might need them at some point. It's not possible to talk about raising taxes. Now, the opposite is the truth out in the general public, where people have been polled since the mid-70s on whether they'd be willing to pay a little bit more money to keep their Social Security solid. And consistently, people are willing to do that. It's a very popular program and one that people understand is extremely important to them in terms of funding their old age. And so you have a sort of a really profound political disconnect between Washington, and that includes the mainstream media that cover events in Washington, and the rest of the general public. It's a political crisis. It's not a fiscal crisis. The fiscal aspect is something that can be easily dealt with without cutting anybody's benefits.
Right. Eric Larson, it seems to me that, in fact, that there really is a crisis in this country around who gets income and who gets what. And the real crisis is that the bottom, whatever, 85, 90% are basically losing income and becoming much more insecure and rapidly losing wealth. That is the backup they have if things get bad, and they generally do get bad after age 65 or 70 or even before. There really is a crisis, and if, in fact, income shares reverted to, let's say, what they were 20 or 30 years ago when it was still very unequal, income shares went for the bottom 80% went up, it means the payroll tax would bring in a huge amount more money. One reason that Social Security is not bringing in, the payroll tax is not bringing in as much money as it should, is because ordinary people's incomes have gone so down. I mean, if we've solved that crisis, the Social Security crisis, what it seems to be, whatever, crisis in quotes, it would disappear, is my sense.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Bill. In fact, in 1983, when the last major changes were made to Social Security, and there really was a funding crisis that was dealt with in that year, the changes they made were estimated to keep Social Security solvent at least into the 2050s. And the one factor that they had not considered then, and the reason that it dwindled down to 2033, was because wage stagnation continued. Wages were expected back then to revert to their long-term post-war pattern and grow much more solidly than they have. That is the specific reason why we're having this discussion today. But I think that the larger issue here that you raise is really important. It's that since really the Carter administration, really the first capital gains tax cuts were made under Carter, not Reagan, since then the 1%, as they're now known, have been able to create a very, very favorable situation for themselves through tax cuts, Reagan tax cuts, Clinton tax cuts. There were some significant tax cuts under him, the Bush tax cuts, of course. And the preservation of most of the Bush tax cuts by Obama, the overriding concern of the 1% in this country, and this can't be emphasized enough, is to preserve that favorable tax situation for themselves. That's their number one priority, and extend it if possible. And one of the reasons for their opposition to any solution to Social Security that doesn't involve cutting benefits is a fear that ultimately to raise the cap or to raise payroll taxes across the board is going to fall more heavily on them. It's going to cost them. And that's something that they absolutely want to prevent from happening.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Eric Larson, who wrote the book, The People's Pensions. It's about Social Security and the enormous folly, and not just folly, but the immiseration that, in fact, today's Obama proposals and any of the proposals to cut benefits would cause. Eric Larson, so many people are dependent on Social Security. Up to 2/3 of people, it's their bulk of income. 1/3 of people, it's all they have to live on. I mean, it's really a policy for immiserating the elderly poor, the most defenseless people in this society. I mean, it is really criminal what they're doing.
Yeah, in fact, it's not just the elderly poor. Social Security is the largest program in terms of dollars for children in this country. It prevents a great deal of poverty among children as well through survivors' benefits. What's really unconscionable to me is that the discussion in Washington around Social Security has absolutely no reference at all to the crucial role that Social Security plays and to the fact that Social Security is really increasingly all that people have to take care of them in retirement. Today, 21 million people are kept out of poverty every year by Social Security. This is only going to become a more serious situation for people who are younger workers today. They're going to be without employer-based pensions for the most part. They're going to be without home equity. They're going to be without a significant ability to save on their own because of student debt and consumer debt that just piles up and piles up. Social Security is the one thing they have to rely on. We should be talking about how to improve it and make it more generous rather than less. And yet the discussion in Washington has absolutely no reference to this problem.
The president has just proposed what he calls a chained consumer price index. And he says it's not really correct in comparison to the old consumer price index. Of course, it reduces income over time enormously when you change the COLA. And he also says that, oh, he's going to ensure that the really needy older people will have other programs to fall back on. Those, of course, are not defined. Tell us about that fairly briefly. It seems to me that those are just phony ideas.
The chain CPI is a measure that the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Labor Department put together, and it's thought to be, by some, a more accurate measure of how prices rise or how the cost of living rises every year. And the idea is that the consumer price index that is now used to compute people's benefits, the cost of living increases that are made each year, should be replaced by the chain CPI. Again, they say it's more accurate. That may be the case for most people, but is not more accurate for people who are retirees, who consume more goods and services like health care that you can't really substitute for. The sort of the basic idea of the chain CPI is it takes more of into account substitutions that people make. If beef is too expensive this week, you buy chicken and so forth. Well, that's fine on a general level, but elderly people who consume a great deal of health care goods and services, for example, usually can't make substitutions for those. There's one thing that you need to buy, and that's it. And so it creates a very inflexible situation. The real reason for the chain CPI is not that it's more accurate, of course, but that it would result in benefits growing more slowly, which means the standard of living for the elderly will fall behind over a period of years. We're talking about, let's say, a 3% drop in standard of living, or rather 3% drop in benefit, real benefits, over, let's say, 10 years. That's a very significant thing. An awful lot of people on Social Security live just this side of the poverty line. So with that kind of a cut, we're really talking about shoving people into poverty. Now, Obama's talked about what he calls the birthday bump, which would raise the benefits back up for people over 76 or 75, 76 years old. The problem is that the sort of calculations that I've seen on this indicate that it wouldn't raise those benefits back fully. Those people would also be under a great deal of pressure by the time they are age 75, 76. You'll already have people sliding into poverty. So it's not an adequate solution to the problem. Also, it's funny because it belies the rationale for the chain CPI to begin with. If it's a technical correction and it doesn't harm anyone, then why do they have to correct it for people over 75? It's sort of an admission on their part that what they're doing is really just a cynical, backhanded way to cut benefits.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Eric Larson about his critique of Social Security reform, in quotes, and the Social Security crisis, in quotes. Eric Larson, this is not new, the attack on Social Security. What is new is that conservatives control everything, and they may even be able to push through this current wave of reform now being pushed by our president. Tell us about the history of the attack on Social Security. The Clinton story, of course, is one of the most amusing, actually, and informative. And why they're doing it. What is it that conservatives, why do they hate Social Security so much, or any kind of public program to assist the poor?
Well, of course, conservative opposition to Social Security goes back to the New Deal itself and the passage of the Social Security Act. At the time, it was very common for conservatives to label any kind of program like Social Security, a social insurance program where people pool their money essentially, people contribute to a program that pays out benefits, people contribute directly, which is why Social Security is different from a welfare system. It's something that we fund ourselves. It belongs to us. It was very common to hear conservatives refer to it as a form of communism back then. And conservatives, even in the sort of golden era after World War II, the Eisenhower years in the 60s, conservatives were never comfortable with the idea and were always looking for some way to attack it. The opposition to Social Security really focuses on what I call the social insurance aspect, which is the fact that it's an earned benefit. It's not like welfare. You pay for your Social Security and you receive benefits because you've been paying into and participating in the system all your working life. And conservatives are actually very frank about this, that with that kind of structure, cutting welfare is one thing, because you can caricature welfare recipients as being leeches and parasites and welfare queens and all this sort of thing. It's difficult to do that with Social Security because people pay for it directly. And so really what conservatives have tried to do for years and years is to turn Social Security into more of a welfare-type system. That's why they support things like means-testing benefits, because then it's not about the fact that you contributed to it. It's about the fact that you have X amount of wealth more than somebody else, that they can, through those kinds of changes to the program, they can turn it into something that looks more like welfare, and therefore it's easier to cut. And that's really what they've tried to do.
Yeah, that's their strategy, but let's talk about why they're doing it. It's actually not in their interest. They're much better off having a working class that's relatively secure, that can raise its kids, that contributes to the economy instead of trying to immiserate everybody. But they don't understand that. Why is it that they can't understand the dynamics of a relatively successful capitalism even?
Well, because, first of all, we have a much more ideological conservative movement today than we did even 30 years ago. You remember what unlamented Margaret Thatcher, said, there is no such thing as society. There are only individuals. And that really is sort of a core belief of conservatives these days. Anything that smacks of social solidarity, which is the attractive thing about Social Security, is anathema to them. That's something that has been removed from the private sector. Therefore, it is automatically unproductive and inefficient and no good. So we're talking about some pretty profound beliefs. The second thing is, again, my feeling about it is that what the conservatives are most concerned about these days is that we do have an aging population, and it will be necessary to spend more money in general to take care of older people in the decades ahead. When they hear that kind of analysis, what conservatives see is taxes. And that some of those taxes will fall on us, and we do not want to have to support these people. So the goal right now is to shift the cost of taking care of the elderly, i.e. through Social Security and Medicare, from the state or from any kind of collective arrangement like Social Security onto individual households so that it does not become the focus for a drive for higher taxes. That's their number one overriding priority.
Eric Larson, there's a number of other sort of explanations which I'd just like to mention. Let me suggest also that to some extent it's almost a sort of religious commitment that conservatives have that started long before, but it was really intensified by the hatred of the New Deal. The New Deal really, and sort of Roosevelt, but really was the rising of all of the unions and popular movements that drove the New Deal and kept driving it into the 60s, and conservatives lost an enormous amount of power and prestige in that period, and they're still trying to regain it. They really resent all of the programs that gave security to, or more security and higher income, as well as power in the workplace. They resent that, and in the home and everywhere else, they resent that very, very deeply. And any of the programs that contributed to that, it seems to me, there's just this blind hatred that they've managed. It's like the Civil War. It doesn't go away, the Civil War in the South. They're still fighting for the Confederacy, that is the elites. And that seems to be partly explained. And partly, of course, anything that gives economic security to people is anathema to the rich, because when people are secure, they can fight back. And they aren't as worried, and they can more easily find another job. And so they like a weak and defenseless working class, despite the fact that, of course, they're destroying the country. That's another matter. Eric, I'm afraid I stole the last word, but I'm sure you agree. It's just thanks a lot for talking to us.
Absolutely. Thanks. It's been a pleasure, Bill, and I'm glad to be on the show.
Yeah. Let's do it again. Thank you.
I'll teach you to be happy. I'll teach your grandmother to suck eggs. Now, boys and girls, let's try it again.
Happy, happy, joy, joy, happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy, happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy, happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy, joy.
Oh, yeah, so happy. For those of you who don't know, that was the Happy, Happy, Joy, Joy theme song from the acclaimed cartoon Ren and Stimpy. And up before that, we heard Bill Resnick talking with Eric Larson, author of The People's Pension. They were shedding some light on the Social Security crisis. Up next, we have Left in the Law, Mike Snedeker and Jan Hawken. They will discuss Oregon's budget crisis and how prisons and punishment laws are affected by it.
Well, prison politics are in the media spotlight these days, driven largely by budget crises, including here in Oregon. Governor Kitzhaber is responding to economic and political pressures to reduce our prison population, at least to reduce projected increases over the next decade. In an article in the Willamette Week on March 13th, and in response to the governor's plan, progressives were implored to recognize that Oregon is a national leader in how it incarcerates citizens. State and federal data show that Oregon is one of the most effective corrections models anywhere in the U.S. The system uses prison sparingly, locks up the right people, and helps keep them from reoffending. Well, Mike, you responded on the Willamette Week blog to that article mocking this position that we, as presumably liberals, progressives, accept the bitter pill that prisons do in fact work. What is the basis of this position Willamette Week takes that sounds like a press release from the DA offices around the state?
It's a very deceptive article that is precisely that. It's a product of the alarm felt by the prison industrial complex at the fact that crime has been falling steadily for over 20 years all over the country. And there's a bit of a lag, but people are now recognizing that there are surely better ways to spend money than building prisons. So they've embarked on a campaign here in Oregon to support the continued incarceration and the continued increase in the rates of incarceration. The article is fraudulent. There's a no lesser word is appropriate because its statistics are so selective. For example, it says that Oregon is more selective in its incarceration than the United States. And it's true that Oregon locks up about 370 people per 100,000, and the U.S. as a whole locks up about 500 per 100,000. But that figure is dramatically skewed by the former slave states. The South incarcerates 700 and 800 people per 100,000 in Louisiana, Mississippi. But if Oregon is compared to states like it, for example, Minnesota or Washington, we'll find that Oregon incarcerates twice as many people as Minnesota does, and a third as much as Washington. And the crime rates have fallen even more sharply in Minnesota than they have in Oregon. The crime rates have also fallen more in the state of Washington than I have here. Those states spend a greater proportion of their budget on universities and less on prisons.
So you're saying that if you disaggregate or unpack these data from that kind of main effect where Portland or Oregon looks pretty good if you chart it against national data, but you're saying a more meaningful comparison are states with lower incarceration rates and lower crime rates, because, of course, these DA offices claim, yes, crime is down throughout the country because we incarcerate so many people and longer. But you're saying if you look, you can kind of unpack that claim if you look at a state level of the interactions between incarceration rates and crime rates.
Yeah. John F. Kennedy once said after the Bay of Pigs fiasco, victory has 1,000 fathers. Defeat is an orphan. Everywhere in the country, politicians are taking credit for the decrease in crime if their policies happen to be more police on the streets. There's been a very dramatic drop in crime in this country. Property crime peaked out around 1980, and violent crime peaked out around 1990 or 91. But the murder rate last year was less than half of what it was in 1991. And I can understand politicians rushing to take credit for whatever policies they adopted during this time, even if they're contradicted by policies in other states. But for somebody like the Willamette Week, who's ostensibly a newspaper, to swallow the local line that our particular policies have directly affected the crime rate, it's unfortunate.
Well, there's the one of the threads of the argument that seems to be a central one is the category of violent crime that by some standards, effective prisons make a distinction between victimless crimes or nonviolent offenses and violent crime, and that people seem to be more comfortable with increasing incarceration rates for violent crimes. That's part of the drive behind some of the mandatory sentencing practices. What about this category of violent crime? What's carried in that category in terms of what constitutes a violent crime?
Well, in the state of Oregon, every sexual offense is categorized as a violent crime. I don't know about other states, but I know it's extraordinarily broad. For example, the crime of sexual misconduct is committed when you have unmarried sex with a person who's under the age of 18. I'll bet a substantial portion of our listeners would be violent criminals under Oregon statute. It's also inflated by the fact that we have, until recently, jury instructions that made anybody liable for any crime that somebody else committed in a group, even if that was not the crime the group originally intended to commit. So between conspiracy laws and accomplice liability, natural and probable consequences, jury instructions, there's a whole host of people who are locked up who never did any violent thing, who never hit, punched, stabbed, or shot, or done the things that people normally think of when they think of violent crimes.
So what would be a kind of typical or common case of that, if you could sketch that out in human terms, the aiding and abetting a violent crime, or someone's with others or in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Anytime you've got a crime committed by more than one person, everybody within that group is liable for everything that happens, regardless of what they originally intended. So the first question, of course, is whether locking people up in a room the size of a ping pong table, as noisy as can be, in any way changes them or makes them less likely to commit crimes in the future, because they will be released. But the article relied on a definition of, quote, violent crime that is extraordinarily broad and includes huge numbers of people who never actually did a violent thing.
And that would seem shocking in a sense, because it, on the face of it, I think even the term violence invokes a kind of moral sympathy, because violence is, as the term refers to, destructive threats that justify an intervention, and that is the case. And so it's, I think, difficult to kind of parse these data to see what is carried by that term. And the term itself is invoked to rationalize these distinctions, categories between violent and nonviolent, you're saying, is a way of kind of rationalizing the criminal justice system in moral terms.
Well, yeah, it's taking advantage of everybody's visceral response to the word violent and expanding it. The crime of promoting prostitution is classified in Oregon as a violent crime. It's a flexible category like that is used to support the continued incarceration of a disproportionate number of people. I mean, the statistics show, if anything, that incarceration adds to rather than detracts from the crime rate. A dramatic example is Florida and New York. Florida has embarked on a prison binge. They now incarcerate twice as many people as they did 15 years ago. New York had a brief increase in the mid-90s, which is now gone away, and they're incarcerating a smaller percentage of people than they did 20 years ago. The crime rate has dropped slightly in Florida. The crime rate has completely tumbled in New York. It's a fraction of what it was 25 years ago,
and
even though they've not been building prisons.
Now, one of the political issues that drives some of the prison politics is the sentencing for drug offenses. And the article claims that 6% of Oregon inmates were doing time solely for drug offenses, and that we're doing quite well in this state on that front. That how would you respond to that claim, that there's been a drop in nonviolent drug offenses?
I couldn't really say, Jen. I don't know. I've just have researched the overall incarceration rates, which is kind of a lump sum that takes into effect longer sentences, incarceration of greater numbers of crimes, and combines all that into just an overall percentage of people who you're locking up. For what it's worth, by the way, the United States has 5 or 6% of the world's population, and we lock up almost a quarter of all prisoners on this planet.
So these comparators, yeah. So the baseline data for the article are U.S. data, and so once again, it's really important to look at the comparators. And if these data were set against international rates of incarceration, they would look pretty horrific.
Yeah, and I'd like to see the justifiers compare Oregon to Washington and Minnesota instead of Mississippi and Louisiana, and see how we do.
Yeah. So are there any organizations or activist initiatives on this front supporting reduced incarceration rates and dismantling our prison system? And in closing, is there any place you'd like to direct listeners to get involved in this issue?
Well, the Partnership for Safety and Justice is an organization that's working steadily to reduce the numbers incarcerated, but they're not big enough to concern the prison industrial complex. It's the governor himself, and as it has the politics of decarceration are now seizing hold of this country as we recognize the crime rates have drastically and steadily fallen for the last 20 years, at the same time as our public funds available continue to shrink as well.
Thanks so much for being with us today. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking about prison politics for the Old Mole.
Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to? All on that day, will I run to the rock? Please hide me and run to the rock. Please hide me and run to the rock. Please hide me, Lord, all on that day. But the rock cried out, I can't hide you, the rock cried out. I can't hide you, the rock cried out.
Yes, the incomparable Nina Simone with Sinner Man. We had just heard Left in the Law, Mike Snedeker and Jan Hawken discussing the Oregon budget crisis and prisons and punishment. Up next, Alan Weider talks about Chris Hani, the 20 years ago freedom fighter, leader of South African Communist Party, was assassinated by a right-wing Polish immigrant in a suburb of Boksburg in South Africa. Alan Weider put together this piece for the Well-Read Red.
On April 10, 1993, as he returned to his suburban Johannesburg home, South African freedom fighter Chris Hani was assassinated by an ultra-right extremist. At the time, the negotiations to finalize the end of apartheid were nearing the finish line that would become the first South African democratic election in 1994. Hani was a key leader in the African National Congress, South African Communist Party, and Congress of South African Trade Unions Tri-Alliance. In fact, during the exile struggle years with Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, and Gavin Mbeki imprisoned, Hani, along with Oliver Tambo and Joe Slovo, was arguably one of the three key leaders in the struggle against apartheid. Last week, Jay Naidoo, a struggle labor leader himself, connected Chris Haney to the present. His essay, which I will read from, is titled A Culture of Service and Tolerance, Lessons from Chris Haney. 20 years on, and it's sometimes convenient or simply too easy to forget the abyss of civil war from which our leaders drew us back and to speculate on what might have been had the ANC taken a harder line in the negotiation process that led to South Africa's first democratic election. We sometimes need reminding that the liberation movement achieved a political miracle, and we need to remind ourselves of the values held dear by Chris Haney, who represented the best of our patriots in wanting a meaningful democratic outcome for our people. 20 years have passed. What have we learned from the ultimate sacrifice that Haney made on that fateful day 20 years ago? I'm reminded of a profound quote from an NGO I support, which says, "In every community, there is work to be done. In every nation, there are wounds to heal. In every heart, there is the power to do it." The turbulent 80s, the era of our people's defiance, saw the rise of the mass democratic movement led by the African National Congress. The apartheid regime was in a structural crisis faced with the deepening economic catastrophe and a global illegitimacy, which forced a political stalemate in our country. Something had to give. The alternative was a racial civil war. These were momentous times. It needed leaders of courage on both sides to rise above the conflict and see a path to a political settlement. But the release of Mandela and all political prisoners, the unbanning of the African National Congress, South African Communist Party, and other banned organizations, and the return of political exiles also saw a ferocious and brutal response by those right-wing forces opposed to democracy. Thousands of innocent black civilians paid the ultimate price as violence swept townships and people were murdered in their homes and slaughtered in the streets. These were brutal times and fear stalked the land. It is convenient for some today to believe that these were not dangerous times and that we gave up too much in the negotiation process. In hindsight, we did achieve a political miracle. I reflect on some of the things that Chris Haney talked about and shared with me. He decided that he would not go into Parliament, although there was tremendous pressure on him. He was a communist and a Democrat. He felt that power should be built outside of government because of the political lessons he had learned from other transitions. 8 days before Comrade Chris was assassinated in April 93, he was interviewed by social historian Lily Kalinikos. In this interview, on the eve of the 1994 democratic election, he said that South Africa faced a new enemy and a new struggle. That enemy, he said, was socioeconomic. It was about the struggle for jobs, houses, schools, so that we can build a society that cares. What Comrade Chris was calling for was a culture of service, a culture where nurses are guided by an ethic of care, teachers by an ethic of learning, police by an ethic of community safety, and local government by an ethic of service delivery. The new enemy, he said, was corruption, and we in the party have been discussing how we should cut down on salaries of ministers, salaries of parliamentarians, so that if you are in Parliament in Cape Town, you actually rent a flat like everybody else. Importantly, he said in the interview that we must allow the formation of many democratic formations in the country, organs of civil society, independent trade unions, student organizations, teacher organizations, organizations of housewives, women, gays, and more, so that we are kept reminded of the needs of people on the ground. He anticipated the major challenges we would experience as a democracy when he said, "I think finally the ANC will have to fight a new enemy. That enemy would be another struggle to make freedom and democracy worthwhile to ordinary South Africans." Our biggest enemy would be what we do in the field of socioeconomic restructuring, creation of jobs, building of houses, schools, medical facilities, overhauling our education, eliminating illiteracy, building a society which cares, and fighting corruption when power and government position enriches individuals. We must build a different culture in this country, different from Africa, different from the Nationalist Party, and that culture should be one of service to people. This is advice that we must all take to heart. The priority in education is the interest of the child, not the teachers, parents, or government. In health, it is the interest of the patient, and most importantly, for our political and economic elites, it is the interest of the citizen. When all of us take that into our hearts and our actions, then we will have truly understood the wisdom of Chris Hani. That was Jay Nadeau's commemoration of Chris Hani. It is important to emphasize Hani's role in the struggle because his actions speak to the present. Chris Hani not only spoke back to and fought the power of apartheid, but he spoke back to struggle leadership supporting his comrades. Chris Hani believed in democracy from the ground. Speaking at Hani's funeral, Joe Slovo said, "Chris Hani had a dream of democracy. They killed the man, but they can never kill the dream. And the dream Chris Hani had is about to become a reality." End quote. Jay Nadeau wants to see that dream come to further fruition in South Africa and throughout the world. For more on Chris Hani, see Janet Smith and Beauregard Trump's book, Hani, A Life Too Short. This is Alan Weider for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you so much, Alan. Closing our show today, Movie Mole's Jan Hocken and Denise Morris will review the current biopic of Jackie Robinson, 42.
Thank you, Ivan. 66 years ago, Jackie Robinson became the first African-American man to play in a Major League Baseball game in the modern era. And on April 15th, 1947, Robinson stepped out onto the diamond at Ebbets Field as a member of the Brooklyn Dodgers. He wore the number 42. It was in 1977 that Major League Baseball retired Jackie's number 42 jersey, and on April 15th, 2004, the first Jackie Robinson Day was celebrated. And on that day's games, all the players wore the number 42 in honor of Robinson, his achievements on the field as a player, and for his historic breaking of Major League Baseball's color line. Today marks the 10th year anniversary of Jackie Robinson Day celebrations. They will be happening around Major League Baseball. Along with that came the film 42, The True Story of an American Legend, opened this past Friday. 42 is written and directed by Brian Helgeland and stars Chadwick Boseman as Jackie Robinson, Nicole Beharie as Rachel Robinson, Harrison Ford as Dodgers general manager Branch Rickey, and Andre Holland as sports writer Wendell Smith. 42 is billed as, quote, the life story of Jackie Robinson and his history-making signing with the Brooklyn Dodgers under the guidance of team executive Branch Rickey. However, the film actually focuses the true story on a span of just 3 years, starting in post-war 1945, with Branch Rickey's decision to find a black player to be the first. Robinson is picked, tracked down, signed, and the legend unfolds, ending with the Dodgers earning the right to play their crosstown rival Yankees in the 1947 World Series. The Dodgers did not win. I wasn't born yet, but still heartbroken. One reviewer suggests 42 gestures towards the complicated and painful history in which its subject was embroiled, but as a whole, still falls prey to the hero-worshipping fables that most biographies of great athletes do become. And Jan, we agree that there are worse sports movies, and we wanted to give credit where credit is due. And we also come at this from a different vantage point, really.
Right. Different baselines of experience.
Yeah.
To draw on, I guess it's a corny pun there. But I was very informed by this. So I was told later that there wasn't much about what happens in a real baseball game going on here. But actually, I think the film has some merits. I mean, it is a Hollywood film, so we always have this criticism, as it doesn't take up the history of struggle, blah, 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 and of course not. I mean, this character, you know, carries a lot and is a symbol for broader struggles. And I think on that level, it did, in the early scenes, mention that he was court-martialed during the Second World War for refusing to sit on the back of a military bus, and throughout he and his wife in these kind of everyday acts of resistance against racism. He wasn't just this Christ-like pacifistic martyr who turned the other cheek. The whole, I think, thrust of that argument that he not fight back during games was a political strategy that was a response to racism, that Blacks in this country are cast as violent even when they defend themselves. So I thought that it drew that out quite effectively. We were talking earlier on the show today about what it means to be violent and who is cast as violent. And so I think that that came through quite well, the extent to which African Americans on various fronts have had to kind of the level of self-control to function in a racist society, and the kind of the burdens of crossing that barrier and not seeming to kind of rupture it.
Yeah, the film has a couple of really important moments, I think. One of them that is striking to me, and I will admit that as someone who's been watching and following baseball for 40 years, and as well a Dodger fan, this story has been with me, as long as I can remember. Because, of course, there are always children's books, and I read about sports, you know, not the classics, but... you know, there's certainly a lot missing, as I have read beyond about Robinson's life, about his history with the civil rights movement, and what really happened after the film ends. However, one of the moments in the film that I recall surprised me to be there was, there's a moment where Jackie is walking with Rachel Robinson, and they've just been married, and they're walking in Brooklyn, and he... there's a moment where he mocks his compliance and sort of makes fun of this, you know, this expectation that African Americans, blacks at the time, would just be yes sir, yes ma'am people. And so it actually demonstrates this, of course, awareness that we often unbelievably don't get to see about him, that he was very, very much aware of what was going on about racism and his resistance to it, his distaste for it, and his desire to fight back.
I think another, I think, important scene or moment in the film for me in terms of resistance was how much you need support in order to resist oppression. And his performance was deteriorating in that one of these the first games, and because of all of this terrible vitriolic racism coming at him from the manager of the other side, and it was undermining him, even someone of his confidence as an athlete, until one of the team members stepped in, and it was kind of a Hollywood moment. But I think on a social psychological level, it was true. You cannot just stand up on your own to prejudice. You do need to have allies. And I think throughout the film, there were these moments where he had to kind of confront that he couldn't just do it on his own, you know, that he needed the team. But I think on a political level, It was very true, and it departed from this kind of hyper-individualism that sometimes accompanies this kind of legendary athlete.
Right, and the line that the white player uses is, why don't you pick on someone who can fight back? And that, you know, really does set straight the record that Robinson was explicitly not able to and prohibited from fighting back, because that great experiment, quote unquote, was to present the exceptional, the vet, the athlete, the good guy, the cooperative, civil, all of those things, much of them stereotypically racist in their absence from how people thought of blacks. Yeah.
And I think along those lines as well, the film took up this old argument that somehow African Americans or black people in general have a natural physical advantage that downplays, of course, the skill and what's involved in cultivating and developing skills, that this one news commentator said, well, they have a large ankle bone that helps them run faster. And the other news commentators kind of scoffed at that. So it took up that racist discourse around athletics, and I think at various points mocked it.
Yeah, and this stuff happens and continues to happen up through the 50-year anniversary. Even in 1997, there was a very unfortunate moment on air with then Dodgers general manager Al Campanis, who made similar statements about the lack of blacks in management, coaching positions, having to do with not being thinkers. And this was like, I think that still in 1997, many of us think, oh my God, are we still there? But we are. I mean, this is part of the dilemma. And
So what about that whole notion of breaking through the color barrier as a metaphor for the emancipation from our racist past? I mean, the film does kind of celebrate his role in history and breaking through the color barrier. What about that whole metaphor?
Well, Jackie Robinson refused to participate in old timers games as a protest to there being, oversight and non-hiring of blacks for managerial and coaching positions. He still fought against the racism in baseball until the very end, but he also fought for civil rights for black people in general in the country, and was shut down. And I think in two ways. One, very specifically told, if you speak out on this, it will come back to really harm you. Of course, that's baseball and other sports protecting itself, and it continues today. This shut up and play is something that is not just a policing tactic on the part of sports organizations, but fans do it as well. So Robinson, as he is valorized for breaking that color line, he himself was shut down by baseball to speak on behalf of civil rights. And his legend, I think, is still primarily owned by Major League Baseball.
And sanitized.
And
there's
sanitized,
a commodifying
right.
of the Jackie Robinson
yeah.
legend.
And you have to go to folks like Dave Zirin, who wrote, the book, What's My Name Full, Sports and Resistance in the United States. That was his first book, and I highly recommend it to folks. And to Google some of what his writing has been on this film of late, because there's a lot of history there to be dredged up.
And that's perhaps the primary virtue of a film like 42, which is a kind of typical Hollywood production, is to learn more about the backstories and the complex political history of Jackie Robinson and baseball and sports in general.
Right, yeah, and there's other writings to go to. And Lester Rodney, who was a left writer for the Daily Worker, who started the campaign in 1930s to desegregate or to integrate baseball, absolutely, completely missing. But people will find it out in the real world. All right, Jan, well, this is Denise Morris with Jan Hocken for the Old Mill Variety Hour. We've been talking about 42, the new film about Jackie Robinson.
In the street, Jack. Jackie Robinson hit that ball. It went zooming across the left field wall. Yeah, boy.
Yes, yes, Jackie hit that ball.
And when he swung his bat, the crowd went wild because he knocked that ball a solid mile. Yeah, boy.
Yes, yes, Jackie hit that ball.
All right, that was Movie Mole's Denise Morris and Jan Hocken discussing the biopic Jackie Robinson 42. And that was Count Basie on the music there with Did You See Jackie Robinson Hit That Ball? All right, well, it's been a busy day, hasn't it? We've heard Bill Resnick talking with Eric Larson about the Social Security crisis. We've heard Left in the Law, Mike Snedeker, Jan Hocken discussing prisons and punishment in Oregon. Alan Weider talked about the anniversary of freedom fighter, South African freedom fighter Chris Hani. And yeah, gosh, what more do you need for today? Except that at 10 o'clock, we're going to hear Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. At 10:15, we'll hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, we'll hear Health Watch hosted by David Naiman, Dr. David Naiman. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening, as always. And thank you for your contributions, if you made some, to KBOO. We just had our pledge drive, and we appreciate all the support that you always give. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Ivan Hale. Thank you very much. Have a great week.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, April 15th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. Well, the FBI is refusing to provide information on a massive biometric identification database that can identify non-criminal citizens and is doing so. It employs iris scans, all manner of science fiction, horror scenarios that we have no knowledge of whatsoever. Its ability to take measurements from remote locations is truly astounding. Too bad they don't employ this much ingenuity and financial oomph to improving our educational system, which is currently crumbling. Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer has introduced an AIPAC favored bill that would allow Israel, and only Israel among all countries, to discriminate against Americans of Arab descent. And notably, our own Senator Ron Wyden has signed on to this. Further afield, the Venezuelan election's greater determinant on the global stage is already beginning to filter in, though you won't hear it on mainstream media. America's take on Venezuelan politics has always been markedly different from that of other countries. First this, though, from the National Weather Service. Scattered showers today with thunderstorms also possible. We could get a bit of hail, otherwise partly sunny with a high near 55 tonight. More of the same, though partly cloudy, of course, with a low around 40. And tomorrow, sunny skies for at least part of the time. We could end a high around 58 tomorrow night, overcast with a low around 42. For the alternative forecast, we have a waxing crescent root moon in Taurus. It's 4 days old, a synodic forecast. So leafy vegetables and annuals that produce above ground. And also, if you're going to do grains, now's a good time to get those started. The biodynamic outlook moon in Taurus, it's an earth sign, good time for root plants. And the sidereal people agree, as they often do with the biodynamicists. Moon in Taurus, it's a good time for root vegetables, and especially if you're looking for hardiness in drought conditions. Interesting to note that the alternative forecast, which often the advice that it puts out, you can either sort of take it or leave it. But now with the climate collapse upon us, more so now than perhaps ever before, people are beginning to take look a little bit deeper into some of the what the biodynamic people, the sidereal people, all of these different types of farming have to teach us about agriculture and about growing our food under very, very difficult conditions. Take a look at Texas, heading into the third or fourth year now of severe drought. Moving right into today's news. We have this from out of Eugene. After cutting jobs and facing consumer fury over rate increases, the Eugene Water and Electric Board has now grapple with the obvious payback of you are doing something wrong. Then there's always that backslap. Two groups are trying to organize the utilities. 300 unrepresented employees in one of the groups has filed two unfair labor practice complaints against the Eugene Water and Electric Board management. It's unusual for the utility, which went for nearly 100 years without a union forming.